Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon, Pacific time. And if you'd like to be on the program, we have one line open right now that you can call if you have a question about the Bible or about Christianity or about anything related to those general themes. And also, if you have a difference of opinion from the host, want to dialogue about that, feel free to give me a call. Same number in either case, 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. We have calls waiting. We'll go to the phones very quickly here. I just need to make a few announcements. This is going to be a busy week for me, and listeners in California and Oregon will have opportunity, if you're interested, in attending meetings where I'll be speaking, and you can not only hear me speak, but you can also meet people like yourself who listen to this program. And on Monday nights, and that's tonight, we have our regular meeting in Salinas in a home. That's a Bible study I teach in 2 Peter, Monday nights. Tuesday night, I teach a Bible study in a home in Santa Cruz. That's a Bible study in the book of Luke. On Wednesday nights, I'm teaching at Twin Lakes Church. Wednesday nights at 6:30. Actually, the other meetings are at 7. But at 6:30 on Wednesday night, teaching at Twin Lakes Church on discipleship or following Jesus. Thursday is the only day this week I'm not speaking anywhere. I'll be traveling on Thursday. Of course, that's the day that the Iranian mighty Grand Mecca has said they're going to have some shocking terrorist attacks or something like that on the West. So I'll be in the air that day, so that'll be interesting. And then on Friday, I'll be speaking in McMinnville, Oregon. I'll be speaking on the subject of intelligent design. On Saturday night, I'll be speaking in Camas, Washington. That'll be an open meeting. We hold that meeting at the Camas Community Church in Camas, Washington. And that's just across the river from Portland, so it's practically Portland and Vancouver. That's an open discussion on Saturday night. And then Sunday morning, I'll be speaking at the same church, two services, 9 and 11. So in the next 7 days, I'm speaking six of them and traveling on one. So that's happening. You can get all the information about any of those gatherings at our website. And there's one additional announcement on our website, very visible there. You'll notice if you go to our website, if you haven't been there for a few days, there's a new link right up over the picture of me and just under the announcements link, and it's for the new Great Commission School. This summer, I'll be teaching a 10-week school, Lord willing, in the Seattle area. It's a live-in course. We're going to go through the entire Pentateuch verse by verse in depth. We're going to go through the book of Job. We're going to go through the book of Mark. And this is just one of five modules I hope to do in the next 2 years. Over the next 2 years, I hope to do five such 10-week schools to get through the whole Bible this way. But this is just one module, 10 weeks. You can read about it if you go to our website. The website is thenarrowpath.com. And you'll see right there, staring you in the face, not just me staring you in the face there, but you'll also see this link that says the new Great Commission School. If you click on that, you can read about that. If you want to do some intensive Bible study in a live-in program in Seattle this summer, you might want to read about that. Or someone you know. Maybe you've got someone getting out of high school this year. And it's a college-level course. It's, you know, if someone's getting out of high school and they want to go, they should be good students. They should be good readers because it's definitely college-level or above. So, but it's intensive Bible study. And that's this summer. You can get information at the link, which you'll find at our website. Now, the other things I mentioned, all the different places I'm speaking this week, you can get by going to the same website and clicking on the link that says Announcement and Speaking Schedule. So you've got the Announcements and Speaking Schedule, and you've got the new Great Commission School link, both right next to each other, right one above the other, at the website. The website is thenarrowpath.com. Thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk to Sandy calling us from San Jose, California. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, Steve. Happy Monday. Thanks for taking my call again.
Thanks. Glad to.
Hey, just I have two questions. The first one I think is an easy one. The second one may be a little more complex. The first one is just a straightforward question. Revelation 12, the preterist viewpoint, looks like there's two views there. One is that starts the Romans being kind of judged or kind of turmoil within the Roman Empire. The other interpretation is that it's a continuation of the Israel or the Jewish persecution. And I'm reading your book, and it looks like both of those are in there. I'm just curious which side of the fence you're on, you know, with that particular question.
Well, the first view you mentioned is that of Jay Adams and some other preterists. It was the view of Louis de Alcazar, the Jesuit, who sometimes is credited with being the first preterist. He was not, but those who are critical of preterism sometimes say he was. That view is that the first 11 chapters of Revelation are primarily about the destruction of Jerusalem, and then chapters 12 through 19 are about the destruction of the Roman Empire. However, even if it were true, and I don't hold that this is so, even if it were true that chapters 12 through 19 were about the destruction of the Roman Empire, you really don't find the Roman Empire on that view until chapter 13. Chapter 12 would be preparatory. 12 actually, goes back to the birth of Jesus and the Jews fleeing from the Romans into the wilderness. The woman who bears the child would be Israel in this view, and the reason she flees in the wilderness is because of the Roman siege, and the remnant of Israel fled, that is the Jewish Christians, fled from that siege, and you see the woman fleeing into the wilderness there. So that's how they would see that. I do see chapter 12 that way, but I don't see the paradigm of the book of Revelation that way. That is, I don't think that chapters 12 through 19 as a whole are about the destruction of the Roman Empire. But I do think that Revelation 12 is describing the birth of Jesus and the flight of the remnant of Israel from the danger posed by the Roman invasion, and they're fleeing into the wilderness where they're nourished.
Okay. I want to get a backdrop on that because I'm reading through the Revelation, the book you have, and I got to that point and was wondering where you sit on it. So, because I'm actually outlining the book of Revelation from a preterist viewpoint, just because I can remember this stuff because there's so much symbolism in there. So,
yeah. Well, I should clarify that I'm not strictly preterist on everything in the book of Revelation. I'm partially preterist. And I'm also partially idealist. The fourth view, that's called the spiritual view there. On much of this middle section of Revelation, I take the idealist approach.
Okay. Oh, interesting. I like the idealist approach because it gives you principles to live by. And
yeah.
So I have a different question, totally unrelated, and I'm going through your spiritual warfare series, and I'm really enjoying it. But I got to a point in it where I really take exception, and I want to make sure I understand your viewpoint first.
Okay.
You kind of went down you do these tangents, which I actually enjoy, your tangents, and you went down a whole tangent on psychology or medicine, you know, people that have, that are ADD or have bipolar, you know, that they take medicine and that's maybe not the right thing to do. You went in to say that, you know, it's not the same thing as a person who needs insulin. I just want to get your make sure I understand what you're saying there. Because I think what you're saying is you don't believe drugs should be used at all for clearing, for helping mental disorders. So is that what you believe?
My view is that mental disorders, so to speak, are not the same as physical disorders. That's why I said that it's not the same as giving insulin to a diabetic. A diabetic needs insulin because the body needs insulin. And the failure of the pancreas to produce insulin is a deadly medical condition that if it is not righted with the giving of insulin, the person will die. It's actually a medical condition. What are usually called mental illnesses have never been proven to be medical conditions. They are treated and spoken of as if they are part of the medical field, the mental health field. But health is really kind of would have to be a metaphor here, because when we talk about health, we're usually talking about something that can be measured, has to do with the body functioning properly and so forth. And illness would be where the body isn't functioning properly. It has never been shown that mental illnesses, as they are sometimes called, really correspond to an illness in the body or in the brain even. You see, the brain and the mind, I believe, are not the same thing. The brain can be damaged. The brain can have a tumor, or the brain can have chemical imbalances, and this can be a medical condition. But that's not a mental illness. A brain tumor is not mental illness. There can be a thyroid disorder that affects the chemistry of the body and the brain's function. That's a medical condition, not a psychiatric or a mental condition. Mental illness is a term that is used when they don't really have any physical explanation, when it's not a medical condition, and it's simply a behavioral problem. That is, a person is behaving in a way that is bad for themselves or bad for others or annoying to those around them. And therefore, it's behavior. It's not physiology. And now, of course, there's all kinds of people out there who are going to be angry at me and say, no, it is physiological. There's schizophrenia is a genetic condition and so forth. No, it isn't. And I challenge anyone to prove that it is.
Let me just ask a specific question then. So are you saying that anyone that has schizophrenia or these, they shouldn't be taking medicines? They should be cured, if you will, through the Bible or through the Holy Spirit or through, other Christian strategies, for lack of a better word? Is that what you're saying?
I would not say that people should not take medicine. I think they should take medicine if they're sick. As far as psychiatric, psychoactive drugs, those are not medicine because they're not curing any physical condition. They are simply disabling certain brain activity. Now, to me, disabling brain activity with chemicals is not a desirable thing, but it may be more desirable than something else. My position is that if people are misbehaving, there are remedies other than chemicals that I believe are available. But if a person does not avail themselves of those remedies, then maybe chemicals are better than nothing. In other words, I don't think straitjackets are desirable, but if somebody won't control himself and is behaving dangerously, then a straitjacket is better than nothing. And same thing with a padded cell. I believe that most psychiatrists would agree and would confess that a psychoactive drug serves as a chemical straitjacket. It doesn't cure anything. It just subdues behaviors. Now, if behaviors are very dangerous or undesirable, and the person finds no other way to control himself, then I think a straitjacket or a chemical straitjacket may be the only thing left. So I'm not saying that a person shouldn't take drugs. I'm saying there are better things they should do first. Drugs would be the last resort, I would think.
Okay, so I appreciate your answer. I feel better about your answer, although I don't fully agree with it. And I just want to throw this out to you. I mean, love everything you do, and this is one area that I have personal experience in, both with myself and other people I know.
So do I. Mm-hmm.
And, what I found, and this is where I think the church is going amiss, quite frankly, where people dealing with the issue I was dealing with, people say, well, you need to fast, you need to pray, you need to read the Bible more, you need to confess sins, you need to be in fellowship, all the things that we would do as a Christian. And I'd do every one of those, and never got relief, for lack of a better word. And to me, when you say things like this or when you talk about this, to me it's really could be damaging because there are things that happen in the brain that are physiological that I believe, like you were talking about lithium, how that you were talking about in your the series about lithium, and it's not a natural thing in the body, and I get that, but at the same time, when we have surgery done, right, why do they give us painkillers, it's not a natural substance in the body. And what I would ask of you, Steve, is to really sit back and rethink about your position on this.
I've thought it and rethought it and thought it and rethought it for at least 20 years now. And I've had quite a few experiences with people who are friends of mine, or even closer than that, closer than friends, who have definitely had behavioral disorders. And my position is, my position cannot be dangerous, because my position is, if a person doesn't control it one way or another, they're going to have to control it with drugs. So, in other words, if people follow my advice, they will be under control. I'm saying the drug should be the last thing they try. Because I don't. What's that?
What would be the first thing you'd recommend then if someone is going through some type of emotional distress or psychological disorder? What would be the first things you'd recommend for them?
First thing I'd recommend is to ask, is this something that's an affliction or something that's a sin? Because a person may be sinning or they may simply be afflicted. Now, afflicted means they're suffering. Okay?
Right.
Now, you can suffer without sinning, and you can sin without suffering. All right? So if a person's behavior is they're uttering blasphemies uncontrollably and making life miserable for the people around them and things like that, that's sin. Okay? Those are sins. And,
right.
and the Bible does talk about what to do about sin. You have to repent of sin. You need to walk in the Spirit, and then you will not fulfill the lust of the flesh. One of the fruits of the Spirit is self-control. So people who walk in the Spirit exercise self-control. Now, if on the other hand, it's not sin. For example, let's say just a person is really depressed a lot, or they're tormented in some way. Well, if there is a physical cause for that, then I'm never opposed to using medical help for things there's a physical cause for. If there's not a physical cause, then I would not think that drugs are a very good remedy. Now, if someone wants to take drugs and take all the risks that come with them, because they are risky. I mean, there's some terrible side effects that most of the drugs can bring, including permanent movement disorder and nerve damage and all kinds of things. If people want to take that risk, that's their business. I personally would rather just stay depressed, I think. I mean, there is such a thing as experiencing great pain and sorrow and not sinning. You're not sinning, and therefore, although it's an unpleasant situation, it may not be any more unpleasant than that which many people have who have crippling disabilities in the physical area. I mean, Christians do have to suffer in this world. I'm not saying they have to suffer without relief if relief is available, but we have to be careful about what kind of relief we're talking about. It's like if I'm very depressed, for example, it may be possible that I could go out and drink a pint of vodka and I'd feel a lot better. But that's not a means of relief that I as a Christian would approve of for myself. It would change the chemistry of my brain, certainly. It would it would elevate my mood in all likelihood. But I guess the question is, would it please God more for me to endure a low mood, which I'm not causing, and of which I'm merely a victim? Or to resort to something that would alter my brain in ways that I don't think are necessarily consistent with my Christian convictions. Consciousness-altering drugs I'm talking about, whether it's alcohol or any other consciousness-altering drug. Now, if my brain actually has a problem and a medicine fixes that physical problem, that I'm never opposed to that. That's not psychiatric. That's medical. Psychiatric diagnoses basically are a psychiatrist's opinion about someone else's behavior. That's what psychiatric diagnosis is. And you say there's certain physical causes, and I guess wherever there is truly a physical cause, that's a medical condition. But I'm talking about cases where they're not medical, and most psychiatric diagnoses have never been the result. A person is diagnosed as schizophrenic usually without necessarily any medical evidence for it. I mean, a psychiatrist sometimes can diagnose someone as schizophrenic over the phone. It's an opinion. It's an opinion. It's not a scientific thing.
They've actually done brain scans where they've actually found.
I've seen that. I've seen that. I've seen the brain scans. I've seen the different colored areas of the brain. Yeah, I've seen those. Yeah, but they don't know what is the cause and what is the effect. What came first, the chicken or the egg? Does the overactive brain activity, is that a result of or is that the cause of the misbehavior? I mean, we do know that there are differences in brain chemistry in people when they're angry or when they're happy or when they're sad. There's all kinds of things that alter brain chemistry. The question is, did the brain chemistry cause the mood? Or did the mood change the brain chemistry? We know, for example, that someone who's alarmed can have increased adrenaline levels. But we wouldn't argue that the presence of a higher adrenaline level in an alarmed person means that alarm was caused by high adrenaline. We would say, no, the being alarmed is what caused the high adrenaline. So the thing is, when you see different brain activity in somebody, and you also see their behavior or their moods are abnormal, the question then is the brain activity causing the mood, or is the mood causing the brain activity? You see, the naturalistic science would always take the view that the brain activity and the brain chemistry is causing the mood, because they're naturalistic and they consider that moods are not a matter of free will. They consider that moods are actually caused by the brain. Now, I'm of the opinion that moods may, in some cases, in fact, be caused by free choice or the wrong kind of mental reaction to something in one's environment. So there's the human mind is very complex. I don't deny it. And there is a link between brain and mind that no one could deny. Obviously, if you put a bullet in someone's brain, their mind stops working as well when their brain stops working. We're not going to deny that by any means. But my position is that in the functioning of the personality, in the functioning of the soul, that there are times when I think the soul is operating the brain, not vice versa.
It's interesting. Well, yeah, I appreciate where you're coming from. You give me things to think about.
Tell me the experience that's informing your thoughts about this. You mentioned that you've had some experiences.
Well, I have. I mean, there's a radio broadcast, so I'm not going to put too much out here, But I know for myself, and I also know for other people that I am very close with, that without certain drugs they're on, they just don't function normally. And I know for me, it's what I feel now when you say this is somehow I'm not a good enough Christian to combat these psychological issues through, example, spiritual warfare, or through scripture, or through the Bible, my Christian walk. And in some sense, I'm weaker, that I have to be dependent on some type of a drug. And, it's sort of...
Sandy, if that were actually true, if you found that you were a weaker Christian because you couldn't conquer certain things in your life that maybe some other Christians could conquer, would you find that to be something that would you find that be insulting to you or something?
I don't know if the word insulting is the right word. I just know that there are certain things that when medicine is working really gives freedom, and it's almost like someone could tell me, I'll give you $1 million or whatever your hot button is, if you will see this as black. Just see this as black and you'll get, all your problems will be over, But because of a disorder, I'll always see it as white. It's just the way it is. Someone said, I'll give you $1 million, see this as white, and I'll still see it as black unless there's some type of a medication working. And then all of a sudden the fog goes away, And so, I think there are people that need these drugs, and again, I'm not insulted at all. I having seen other people, I also know, that went off drugs. I know a person who went off who's bipolar, went off drugs and beat his wife up, and he's in jail now and all this, So
yeah, he shouldn't have done that.
No, he shouldn't have, but he was out of control, and so not a big issue. I hear where you're coming from. I appreciate it. I think sometimes we'll medicate things before we go and deal with the sort of naturalistic ones, spiritual ones, or Christian ones, and we need to exercise those first. But I just hate to put it.
Sandy, I hope you're aware that there are people who've been on medications given to them by psychiatrists who went out and committed murder, and many times, and there are cases on that make the news of that. Somebody there's a murder, and it turns out that the guy was on Valium or something. He's on something. That's supposed to be a safe drug. There are certainly people who beat up their wives and should be in jail who aren't even, that they don't even claim to be bipolar. I mean, behavior is either sinful or unsinful. And if we walk in the Spirit, the Bible said, we will not fulfill the lust of the flesh. Now, I just happen to be a Bible believer. That's just where I come from. I believe that if a person walks in the Spirit, they won't fulfill the lust of the flesh. Now, if a person, let me put it this way. If I find that I'm, let's say, addicted to something, I don't know of anything that I'm addicted to, but let's just say for the sake of argument, I was addicted to pornography, I would say. Let's see if I use that term. I'm addicted to pornography. Now, if somebody said, well, you need to walk in the Spirit and you won't do that, I would have to say, well, that sounds biblically true. I think that's true. If I do walk in the Spirit, I won't do that. But then does that mean that because I'm still addicted, that I'm not walking in the Spirit, does that make me less of a Christian than I should be? Maybe it does. But, you know, I'd be willing to say there's a lot of things. Now, I don't have any such addictions as I just mentioned in the illustration, but I certainly am not a perfect man. And whenever I do something that's not perfect, I admit freely I wasn't walking in the Spirit. That's why I failed. If I had walked in the Spirit, I wouldn't have done that. So, in other words, I wouldn't take it as an insult if someone said, Steve, you know, when you lose your temper or whatever, you're not walking in the Spirit and you need to stop doing that. If I said, well, I can take a drug for that, that makes me much more calm. And if you say that I shouldn't take that drug, then you're saying I'm not a good Christian. Well, maybe they are saying I'm not a good Christian, but I should be. I mean, maybe I should say I'm not a good Christian. Who is a good Christian anyway? I mean, we're all sinners. So my thought is, if somebody's failure to walk in the Spirit leads them to beat up their wife, or somebody's failure to walk in the Spirit just means that he gets angry sometimes and doesn't beat up anyone, it's the same phenomenon. It's just a different matter of degree. And walking in the Spirit would have solved either problem.
Right, right. And I think walking in the Spirit, well, you know, I appreciate your time today. I'm going to have my wife listen to the podcast tonight, and I may call you back in a few days with some more dialogue on this because it's...
Sure, Sandy. Now, there's also... have you heard the series I have? I think it's called, what's it called? Oh, Biblical Counsel. It's called Biblical Counsel for a Change. It's at the website. And if you got my lectures on spiritual warfare from the website, it's probably on the same page, the topical lectures. I deal with the whole issue of mental health and so forth, quoting many, many experts and so forth. If you want more of my take on that.
That's cool. I appreciate, and I like you a lot. I love all the stuff you're doing. And so for me to have a conflict on one area is just, is iron sharpens iron and all that stuff. So
sure.
I'll do a little more reading on it, and I'll probably hook up with you here down the road and talk about it a little more, if that's okay.
Okay, Sandy. Thanks for your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye now. All right, our next call comes from Bruce in Las Vegas, Nevada. And if you want to be on the air, the number is 1-800-438-5090. Hi, Bruce. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me. My question
sure.
comes today from 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 3 and 4. I just wonder,
mm-hmm.
like, who, what, and where? Is that something that's already happened, or is this happening? Or is Paul trying to tell all these people this is going to happen when Jesus Christ comes back the second time?
Well, Paul said there's going to be someone called, he calls the man of sin or the son of perdition, rise. This would be sometime after Paul's time. You're wondering if it's still after our time or not, or if it's already happened. That's something that is definitely disputed. Paul says that the rise of this man of sin is hindered by something. A little later in the chapter, he talks about there's something hindering his rise. And when that something is removed, then the man of sin will come to power. The most common view in our day is that the man of sin is a future individual, a world dictator that people popularly refer to as the Antichrist, and that there's something that hinders him from rising right now. But when that something is removed, he will come and he will issue in the last few terrible years of Earth's history before Jesus comes back. That is the dispensational view and the futurist view. And the dispensationalists usually believe that the thing that is hindering the rise of the man of sin is the church here in the world, and that God has to remove the church through the rapture, and then the man of sin will rise. That's what I was taught when I was growing up, and that's what I believed for a long time and taught. There are other views, and perhaps the one that makes the most sense to me today is one that was held by the Reformers, and it was also held by the church fathers. So it's, you know, there's the earliest Christian teachers after the apostles taught the view I'm going to suggest. And
okay.
the Reformers also did. Now, most modern Christians don't, and so just take that with a grain of salt, you know. But the early church fathers, when they commented on this chapter, they said that the man of sin would rise when the Roman Empire would fall.
Okay.
Now, they believed when Paul said, you know what is hindering his rise, that the thing he's referring to is the Roman Empire, that the Roman Empire is hindering his rise because the man of sin could not come to power while the Roman emperors were still there. Now, the church fathers believe that Paul was basing this on Daniel chapter 7. In Daniel chapter 7, there were four beasts, the fourth one, the Roman Empire. And from the fourth beast, there arose a little horn. And the fourth beast was killed, and its body was given to the burning flame. That's the destruction of Rome, of the Roman Empire. And then this little horn that had human traits blasphemed and persecuted the saints and did all kinds of horrible things. And so the church fathers believed that Paul is referring to that little horn when he refers to the man of sin. Now, the little horn was said, the little horn would rise when the Roman Empire was destroyed. So the fathers believed that when the Roman Empire would fall, the man of sin would come. And they thought that's what Paul was saying. And now this is, they said, the reason Paul didn't state it more clearly, because Paul definitely seems to be evasive with this. He says, you know what it is that hinders him. And when that is taken away, that, you know, he doesn't say what it is, but he says his readers know what it is. Well,
yeah.
the church fathers believed that Paul's reason for not mentioning it outright, that it was the Roman Empire, is that he had been kicked out of Thessalonica shortly before writing these letters. He had been in Thessalonica, he had been kicked out because he was accused of saying things that were contrary to Caesar, contrary to the interests of the Roman Empire.
I see.
And that if he had outright written about the Roman Empire has to be removed first, that if that letter fell into the wrong hands, it would only confirm to them that Paul was advocating, you know, the downfall of Rome, which is what he was thrown out of Thessalonica for suggesting. Now, the church fathers who had this view, they did not live to see Rome fall. Okay, they made all these statements in their writings before the fall of Rome, but at least a dozen or more church fathers mentioned this passage and said that when the Roman Empire shall fall, then the man of sin will rise. Well, of course, we live long after the fall of the Roman Empire, and so did the Reformers. And the Reformers held the same view the church fathers held. They held that Paul is referring to the Roman Empire, hindering the rise of the man of sin. But, of course, the Reformers, living centuries later, could look back and say, and this really happened. And they looked back at the fall of Rome and what happened after that. After the Roman Empire fell, Europe came to be dominated by another very powerful entity, which was the Roman Catholic papacy, the popes. And so Luther and Calvin and Zwingli and John Knox and John Huss and Wycliffe, all those guys believed that the Roman Catholic papacy was the man of sin that had arisen upon the removal of the Roman Empire.
Mm.
And to my mind, they have a lot going for them, because if you read all the things that Daniel said the little horn would do and all the things that Paul says the man of sin will do, the Roman papacy has done all those things.
Oh, yeah, in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
There's a lot of similarities there. So, I wanted to get that clear on that, because I want to know what direction to go with that.
Yeah, it's not a popular view today, but it was the universal view of Protestants from the Protestant Reformation until the 19th century. All Protestants believe that. In fact, it's interesting, because if you get the King James Version of the Bible and read the dedication the King James translators in 1611 wrote the dedication to King James at the beginning of the King James Bible. You can find it in any copy. And they talk about how wonderful, what a blessing it is that God has given to England such a great monarch who resists the man of sin.
Hmm.
And they mean the Pope.
The Pope, yeah.
Yeah, because these were non-Roman Catholics, and they were after the Reformation, and they held the view that all Protestants held was that the papacy was the man of sin.
Okay. Well, thank you, Steve, for taking your time to answer that for me. Now, also, I got you on the phone, because it's hard to get through sometimes. When you're coming here on the 20th Saturday?
Yes.
And I'll just go to the library and get on the website, or do you got that guy's phone number?
I do have that guy's phone number. I'll have to find it, though. I don't. Let me look it up here. I should point out the website. The announcement at the website gives the wrong date. It's my fault, but somehow the date got on the website as January 30th, and it's February 20th. So anyone in Las Vegas that is looking at the website to see when I'm going to be there, it is. February 20th, it is not January 30th, despite what the website says. It'll be changed, and it'll be properly done. But if you want directions to that meeting, that's on February 20th at 6:30 in the evening. It's a Saturday, and I'm going to be talking about eternal security and taking questions and so forth on it. You'll call Joe to get directions. Joe's number is 702-564-5627. So it's 564. Yeah, 564-5627.
Okay, I got it. Great. All right. Hey, Steve, God bless you and be safe traveling. Wow, you've got a lot on your plate this week.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
All right.
All right, God bless you, Bruce. Thanks for your call.
Right. Yep, bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, we'll talk next to William, who's calling from Las Vegas also. And we have a line open for you. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. If you'd like to be on the program, you can call with a question or a disagreement, like Sandy did. Sandy had a disagreement. It's just fine. You can call with disagreements. They're welcome here. The number is 1-800-438-5090. William, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
How's it going, Steve?
Good.
I have a question about that scripture that says, I forgot which gospel it was in, but when they were praying in the person, I'm not sure who it was, but it said, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.
Yeah, that's in Matthew chapter 6, and it's also a parallel in Luke.
Okay, well, who was saying that? I mean, who was that talking that was
saying? That was Jesus teaching the disciples how to pray. Jesus said, when you pray, pray like this, Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be your name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Yeah.
The second part to that is, are you familiar with that scripture? I think it's in the Psalms where it says, I am the Lord thy God, I do not tempt, nor can I be tempted.
No, that's in James. James says, God is not tempted with evil, neither does he tempt any man.
Okay. Now, I was just wondering, how do you reconcile those two scriptures when Jesus is telling them to pray and to not lead us into temptation, and yet in James, God himself is saying, I'm the Lord thy God, I do not tempt, nor can I be tempted.
Well, God is not tempted with evil.
Right.
And he does not, when James says God does not tempt any man with evil, he means that God is not the tempter. It says everyone is led away by his own lust. If God wanted to tempt me to sin, then he could certainly succeed because he's strong. He's got all power. And if I sin, I can't say God did it. I can't say God made me sin. That's what James is saying. I have to say I made myself do this. It's my flesh that did this. That's what it says. But at the same time, James is not trying to say that God has never put anyone to the test. And that's really what the word tempt means. The word tempt means to test.
Oh, okay.
We read in Genesis 22:1 that God tempted Abraham. That's what it says in the King James Version. The modern versions say he tested Abraham when he told him to offer up his son. And there's many places in the Old Testament that say that God does test people, like a refiner using fire tests gold and silver. So God tests the hearts of men and so forth. And when Jesus said, you should pray this, do not lead us into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. We have to remember God did lead Jesus into temptation. It says in Luke chapter 4, the Holy Spirit drove Jesus into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. So God does...
Was that an exception, or is that for, like, that can happen to any of us at any time, or is that...
I believe God can test any of us he wants to. The devil is there to test us, and God...
Well, I thought the devil's there to tempt us, and God tests us.
Well, tempting and testing are the same word in the Greek. We have different English words, but the Greek word is the same. When the Bible says the devil's the tempter, it can be translated the tester or the prover. And so what the devil does, he tests us. God allows that. God, in fact, may lead us into a situation where we will be. But the other part of that is, but deliver us from the evil one. Now, when it says, do not lead us into temptation, that's not a complete sentence by itself.
Right.
It's do not lead us into temptation, but deliver us. So the point here is, don't simply lead us into temptation, but beyond that, lead us out of it. You know, deliver us from the evil one. So the idea is not, it's not a complete thought when you say, don't lead us into temptation. It's a complete thought when you take the whole thing, don't simply lead us into temptation, but also lead us beyond temptation, deliver us out of it from the evil one. So the statement actually, in my opinion, presupposes that although there are times when God does want us to be tested and he does lead us into the test, yet we're praying that whenever that happens, he will lead us out safely, undefiled, that we will be delivered from the evil one.
Okay, can I ask you then, where would, as I was listening to your previous caller or the one before that when you were talking about watching pornography or something, where would God be in that as far as his role as, did he put the thought in your mind or you put the thought and then he's like, okay, now overcome it or you'll be succumbed by it? I mean, what role would God play?
Well, any suggestion of sin to your mind is not from God. God does not suggest sin to you. And that's what James is saying. When James says God is not tempted with evil, neither does he tempt any man, he means that he doesn't tempt people to do evil. He doesn't. But the devil does, and God sometimes wants us to endure that test. Obviously, the devil can't test you unless God lets him.
Right.
I mean, think of Adam and Eve in the garden. The devil couldn't have been there to tempt them unless God allowed him to be there in the garden. God didn't have to allow the serpent to be there.
Do you think it's always for a reason, or it's just like, I hate to say for the heck of it, but I'm sure when God may allow, I'm sure there's a greater purpose for that, and I don't think he just does it just for the heck of it, because he's, wants to see us fail or struggle with something.
Oh, no, God doesn't want us to fail. He wants us to pass every test.
Right.
But he wants us to be tested. Like any instructor in a school, you have to give tests to your students. You don't want them to fail.
Right.
But you do want them to fail if they don't qualify to pass. In other words, you don't want them to cheat either.
Right. There's the standard to pass so that you're accepted or...
Right,
or
exactly.
Standard
exactly.
To lose and you don't pass type of thing.
Right. The purpose of testing is to see if somebody has learned certain lessons.
Right.
And if they have, then they will pass the test. The person who's giving the test is not trying to fail the student. The person giving the test is hoping the student will pass. But if the student hasn't learned the lesson, then they will fail. And they'll have to learn the lesson and take the test again. I believe that every time we're tempted with sin or with doubt or with frustration or with discouragement or with anything, anytime we're tested with anything, that God is giving us a chance to pass a test, which if we lose, if we fail, we'll have to learn the lessons that we didn't learn. But the test will show if we've learned the lessons or not. Now, we have to, when you say, does God have a specific purpose for every temptation he lets us face? I would say he does, but I would even put it in a bigger picture. I would say the whole purpose of our living, our lifetime, is to pass a series of tests and to qualify for graduation.
And
graduation happens when we die.
Right, right. Well, I've never heard it like that before, but yeah, that makes sense to me. Another way of putting it, but I understand it. Yeah, I agree with that. Well, okay, Steve, I just wanted that kind of clarified because I was kind of struggling with what that really meant. The, you know,
that,
not...
That is the most confusing line in the Lord's Prayer. That definitely is a confusing line. But I think that when you take both parts of it together and realize that the second part really gives the meaning to the first part, too. I mean, it kind of explains what the first part means.
Right.
That makes it a little easier.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. God
okay,
bless.
William. Thank you. Bye now. Okay, Susie from Monterey, California is next caller. Hi, Susie. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Enjoy talking to you, listening to your program. I just wanted to add, first of all, I want to say that I've been reading Philip Yancey lately,
that
Jesus I Never Knew. Really
I
like
book.
His writing. What do you think about his writings?
Well, you know, I've never read a book-length treatment of his. I have that book on my shelf, and I've thought someday I would read it. I've never read it. I used to read his editorials on the back, the last page of Christianity Today. I used to subscribe to that magazine, and he wrote a lot of editorials, and I thought he was a good writer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm enjoying his books. He's a very good writer, and he goes into the history of Christianity, which I've never really read before, so it's interesting. But another thing I want to ask you, and I got to take my answer on the radio because my phone's going out on me. I can hear it beeping. And Genesis 38, that whole chapter on Judah and Tamar, I read it, I thought, what a dysfunctional family this is, you know. And what's the purpose of this? It kind of popped up, you know, between Joseph, a slave in Egypt, and it popped up between, you know, Joseph's, you know, dreams for greatness. And so, it seemed like an odd story. So is there some kind of purpose there that we should know, or is it just kind of a story that was just a kind of a depressing, disturbing story about that?
Just thrown in there for the sake of depressing us.
Yeah. I'll take my answer on the radio. Thanks, Steve.
Okay, Susie. Thanks for your call. I know. Well, the story of Judah and his children being born is thrown in the midst of the telling of the story of Joseph. In Genesis, chapters 37 to the end of the chapter, it's all about Joseph, except for this one chapter. The story of Joseph begins in chapter 37. We are introduced to Joseph there. He has his dreams. His brothers get jealous. And he gets thrown into a pit, and his brothers sell him to slave traders who take him to Egypt. And then you skip over a chapter, and in chapter 39, verse 1, it picks up the story of Joseph again in Egypt, now that he's been sold there. In between, there's this parenthesis. It's chapter 38. And Joseph's not in it at all. His older brother, half-brother, Judah, is the main character. And it's not known for sure if this story in chapter 38 is being included in its chronological place or if it happened at some other chronological point and was added here because I guess it had to be added somewhere. It's an important story. But it's not clear whether this happened after Joseph was sold into slavery or not. It might have been. But Judah went away from his family, and he found a wife, and his wife had three sons. And so he found a wife for his oldest son, and the wife's name was Tamar. And the oldest son was kind of a wicked guy, and so he died. He died, and the Bible indicates it was God that took him out. He died under the judgment of God. We don't know what he did wrong, and we don't know how he died. It just tells us that God took him out. And so he didn't have any children. And his widow, Tamar, was still a young woman and without children. And under the customs of the day, if a man died and left his widow childless, then she had the right to marry his next oldest brother and have a child by that man. And the first child of that new marriage would belong to the deceased brother. That is, technically, as far as inheritance rights were concerned, the child of the second marriage would be technically the legal heir of the first man who had died childless. That was just a strange custom in the Middle East. It later became codified into the part of the Mosaic Law. It's called the Law of Levirate Marriage. But the law hadn't been given at this time, so they were just following customs. And so she married the next brother, Judah's second son. And the next brother did not want to cooperate. He didn't want to give his older brother an heir. And so he practiced sort of a primitive form of birth control. And his refusal to do his duty to give this woman a child, and his brother, who had died a child, displeased God, and therefore God killed him too. We don't know how. But then there was one son left. Now, Judah had this one son at home who was kind of young, a little young to be married. But it was understood that really he should marry Tamar and give her a child. But Judah was by this time a little, I don't think he knew why his older sons had died, but he saw they had both married Tamar. I think he kind of thought she might be hexed, that there might be some kind of a, you know, bad luck being married to her. So he didn't want to give his youngest son to her to be married. And he put her off by saying, well, he's too young. Why don't you just wait till he's older? And then the son got older, and Judah never did arrange the marriage as he was supposed to do. And so the woman decided to take matters into her own hands. And she knew that her father-in-law, Judah, was on his way to another area where his sheep were sheared. And she went and set up shop by the side of the road disguised as a prostitute. She had a veil over her face, as the Middle Eastern prostitutes would, and she was not recognizable to him. And he decided to use her services, and so he stopped there, and he said, what will you charge me? And well, she said, what do you pay me? And he said, I'll send you a lamb after I've sheared my sheep. I'll send you a lamb back. She says, well, what will you give me for a pledge? He said, well, I've got this ring and this staff here. I'll leave that, and then when I send the sheep back, you can give me back my ring and my staff. So she took it, and they did their thing, and she actually got pregnant, though he didn't know it. And as soon as she had done that, she went and took off the harlot clothing and went back home. And Judah didn't know that he had slept with his daughter-in-law, and thinking she was a prostitute. However, within a few months, she turned up pregnant, of course. And so Judah thought that she'd been sleeping around or something. He didn't know who the father was. He was the father, but he didn't know it. And she turned out pregnant, and because he felt that she had been playing the harlot, as they put it, playing the harlot didn't mean that she had acted as a harlot. That's exactly what she had done, and he'd done it with her. But when they said she played the harlot, it meant that she had been unfaithful to her future husband, which was Judah's son. An unfaithful woman would be put to death. And so Judah said, well, bring her out here and put her to death. And she said, well, I'll tell you what, the father of this baby is the guy who owns this ring and this staff that I have here. And it turned out Judah recognized it was his, and he realized it all came to him what had happened. And he said, well, she's more righteous than I am, because I should have given her my son, and he did. But the child that was born, they were actually twins, and one of them became the ancestor eventually of David, the king, and eventually, of course, of Jesus, because Jesus descended from David. So the value of having this genealogy in here is that we know something about how the family of Judah developed, although through some rather scandalous things. But we have this connecting link then between Judah and later important people like David and Jesus, the Messiah. And I think it's included for that reason, so that we'd have that in that genealogical information. It's a strange story, but lots of the stories in the Bible are strange. And it's not a flaw of the Bible, it's a flaw of the people. The Bible simply reports. You decide. And so the Bible doesn't say this is a good thing. It just reports that this is what Judah did. And that's why it's there, because Judah was an important ancestor of Jesus, and before that, of King David. Well, we're out of time here. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We have a meeting tonight in Salinas. If you're interested in that, there's information at our website about it. Actually, I'm speaking 6 times in the next 7 evenings, different places: Salinas, Santa Cruz, Oregon, Camas, Washington. Information is at the website, thenarrowpath.com. If you'd like to write to us, and maybe you want to help us pay the radio bills, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. The website is thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again tomorrow. We'll continue our discussion.